It's been a great privilege and pleasure for me to be here at All Souls Church this weekend. I'd like to thank your senior minister, Hugh, and his wife, Claire, for their kind invitation and warm hospitality. It's been a great delight for me to be here. I'm from Boston, and I guess the dynamics of our church context will be very similar to what you have here. We are a center city church of a similar size and very multiracial, multi-generational, and I really feel at home being here at your church. Thank you for welcoming me. Earlier this morning, I had the opportunity to be able to talk about what the Bible has to say about doing justice and loving mercy and walking humbly with your God. Micah 6:8. Hear, O man, you know what is good. What does the Lord require of you? And this was the expectation, the demand, the command that was given by God through the prophet for his people. So I'd like to follow up here as we look at another passage that is highlighting the importance of recognizing our responsibility as God's people, especially within the church community, as Apostle Paul says in Galatians 6:10, that we ought to do good to everyone, especially those in the household of faith. But what the implications are for us to be able to live a gospel-shaped life as it relates to engaging our culture in a way that is generous, fair, equitable, just, and loving. But before doing that, I'd like to make one comment. And that is, when Christianity is situated in a particular social location, it all depends on what the location is. If, for example, Christianity is in a location where there are strong political power structures, where there is a totalizing political structure, where there's a whole lot of authority that is being used by a few officials, then in that context, because of the situation that it finds itself, Christianity will seem extremely, extremely liberal and subversive and progressive. But on the other hand, if Christianity finds itself in a social location such as the one we find ourselves here in London or in Boston or in the Western world, in urban settings, which is extremely modern or late modern, and it is overly individualistic, then Christianity is going to seem reactionary and overly conservative. So it always seems left to the right and right to the left. Christianity is that reality, the power, which is the gospel, salvation unto God, where we are able to transcend whatever our social location is. That it does not get co-opted or absorbed by the baseline cultural narrative. It does not. It's an independent power. It is the work of God that comes to be able to speak into challenging social locations, even the one that we find ourselves in at this very moment. So the reason why I mention that is because when we look at this passage, some of you, depending where you are on the ideological spectrum, might say, not sure if you're overselling that. Or if you're on the other side of the ideological spectrum, you're saying, you're underselling that. And that's what we're going to see, because that's what the Word of God, that's what the gospel does. You can't put Jesus or the gospel or Christianity into a tight, small worldview tribe and for that to function according to the needs that you have. It doesn't work that way. It transcends whatever, wherever you are and whatever situation that you're in. So I want us to consider, again, as James says here, this is true religion or religion that is pure and undefiled. that's incorruptible. And I want us to look at it in these three ways. First, we're going to look at what false religion is. And of course, when James uses the word religion, he's not using it in the early Jewish Pharisaical a renewal program like the Pharisees. He's not talking about that kind of religion where the gospel is opposed to that form of legalism or that form of Pharisaism. But he's using it in a positive way. He's using it in a general way. So again, the first we're going to look at what false religion is. And secondly, we're going to look at what true religion is, a religion that is pure and undefiled. And thirdly, we will consider how do we apply true religion and not false religion in our lives and in our church. The first is, what is false religion? Well, you have to go to a few verses prior to this passage. Let's look here in verses 22 and following. James says, "But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves." He uses this word multiple times, deceiving yourself. Don't deceive yourselves. It also says here in verse 26, deceiving is hard. It's also used in verse 16, do not be deceived. So, but be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Verse 23, for if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks intently at his natural face in a mirror. For he looks at himself and goes away and at once forgets what he was like. But the one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres, being no hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, he will be blessed in his doing. If anyone thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his heart, this person's religion is worthless. So what James is saying here is pretty straightforward, right? I mean, James is very direct. The problem that we have with the book of James is not because he's clear. Our problem is he's too clear. And we have problems obeying what he has to say. It's not as though he's confusing. There are certain parts of scripture you read and you're like, what does that mean? James is just a simple preacher. And he's just telling it like he sees it. And so what he's saying is, if you hear doctrinal truth like you do every day and every week at this wonderful church, you hear the truth of God's word, you hear the promises of the gospel, you recognize the finished work of Jesus through his life, death, and resurrection, you recognize that the salvation and the redemption that you have is through the blood-bought work of Jesus and the resurrection power and his ascended rule. If you know all these things, that's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's important for you to know what the Bible has to say about the nature of God, the person of Jesus, the implications for his people. However, if you simply receive data and there is in a sense, information download, that you receive the curriculum and you receive all of this knowledge, even though the knowledge is beautiful and good, and yet you do nothing with it, then you're like the devil. I want you to know the devil, and listen to me carefully. All right, this might be potentially dangerous and tweetable. The devil was not a heretic. What I mean by that is, the devil knew Jesus was the Son of God. It's not as though he was going around saying, oh no, Jesus is not the Son of God. He is some kind of moral teacher, like modern cultures will say, he's a good moralist, he was a good teacher. No, he's not the Messiah. That's not what the devil did. He knew what was doctrinally true. His problem was he hated God. He rebelled against God. His heart was filled with pride, but he knew the truth. It is quite possible. And I'm sure you take great pride in the fact that you are part of this wonderful tradition here at All Souls. And say, This is my church tribe. This is my church community. And I'm so grateful that we have this beautiful gospel balance here at All Souls Church. It's quite possible for you to be able to embrace all that and believe that cognitively to be true. And again, that in and of itself is not the issue. However, if you are not a doer of what you know to be true, James says that's false religion. I understand there are people who don't know the truth, and they're trying to apply something that is not true. Of course, there are problems with that view too, but that's not what James is addressing. He's saying it's quite possible for you to be theologically informed, but your heart to be dead. And that is why you don't do, you don't practice, because it's not a part of who you are. It doesn't reverberate in your heart. There's no great delight and affection for the things of God, and you just simply give mental, intellectual assent. And James is saying that's false religion. He is saying that religion is worthless. And then he goes on to say here in verse 26, if anyone thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, he deceives his heart. So all of the things related to this false religion, one of which would be that you disdain other people for whatever reason. In this case, many of them were wealthy and affluent, and they would demonize people who were needy. So you might be of one particular political tribe, let's say, hypothetically. You're part of the Labor Party, or you support the Labor Party. And you always demonize people who are part of the Liberal Party. Or you're part of the Liberal Party, and you always diminish those who are on the other side politically. Or you're somebody who is extremely hardworking. You're extremely productive and industrious. And so you look at somebody who is not as hardworking as you, who don't put in the same number of hours in his or her career, and what do? You call them lazy. Or you are somebody who is so actively involved in the life of the church, and but yet this other person has been at church for many years but doesn't really dedicate a whole lot of his or her time in investing to the life of the church. And you look at that person and say, well, why would they not do that? Again, having concern for that is completely legitimate, but you become judgmental. And what Apostle Paul says is this, Galatians 5:26, do not be conceited, provoking one another or envying one another. So provoking one another would mean, I have to invoke John Stott here for a moment, but in his commentary, he says, provoking one another, what you're doing is you're having a superiority complex and you're looking at somebody who is below you and you diminish that person by provoking that person, saying, oh, you're not as important as I am. Or if you envy someone, that's somebody who you're below that other person who seems to, according to the culture's evaluation, has a calibration of worth that seems to be a little bit higher in the rank status than yourself. Therefore, you envy that person. By the way, you never envy people who are not near competitors. Nobody envies Jeff Bezos and saying, oh, you know. No, I mean, it's like he's in a completely different realm. You can't even imagine what that kind of life would be. It's always the near competitor, and guess what? They're usually friends. There's a great quote in Hamlet. One of my favorite characters, Iago of Cassio. Othello. And where he says, he looks at the character and he says, he hath the beauty that makes me ugly. See, when we envy other people, that means that there is a beauty in that person that uglifies you. Even though you are pretty beautiful according to whatever evaluation that others have placed on your life. And so that is the heart impulse, to always want to align yourself with one particular tribe and to talk negatively, dismissing. And that's how we use the tongue. What's in the heart will come out. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. No one put that stuff in the heart. So when we say, oh, you know, the circumstances made me do this, or I, you know, I had a long day. So you come home and you say something a little dismissive to your husband or to your wife and say, what's going on here? Why are you getting this? Oh, I'm sorry, I had a long day. As if the length of the day had anything to do with what was in your heart. Well, why are you blaming the day? What did the day have to do with anything? It's what's in the heart that comes out. Right? It's not what goes into the stomach, but what comes out of the heart. And so this is the way one scholar by the name of Zygmunt Bauman, in his book, Modernity and Ambivalence, he talks about how we work with these dichotomies and binaries, where we create different tribes and we exercise our power by excluding others. So if I can exclude that other person who is in the other tribe, who is my opponent, then I'm able to feel as if I have greater value. Miroslav Volf talks about excluding others through eradication, assimilation, dominance, or abandonment. So there are many different ways that we do this, and it's extremely subtle. And if I may say this as an American, British people are good with subtlety. Right? We as Americans, uninformed, we just kind of say it, you know, there isn't a whole lot of nuance and sophistication. But British people can be extremely sophisticated, and after a while you're like, wait, have I just been insulted and I wasn't aware? So you have the gift, you have that gift. So you need to understand that James is addressing these issues, hard issues, and how it comes out through our speech and through our language. And that's false religion. If you simply make mental assent and it does not shape the way you think about everything and the way you speak and the way you treat other people. Secondly, then what is true religion? True religion is, again, verse 27, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this. Two things. Number one, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction. Number two, to keep oneself unstained or undefiled or unpolluted by the world. You see what James is saying here? Again, it's kind of the blade is cutting both ways. He's talking on the one hand, the emphasis of the inner life, but at the same time, he's placing an emphasis on the outer life. He's talking about gospel declaration, but also gospel demonstration. He's talking about the issues of the Great Commission as it relates to one's conversion and piety, but he's also talking about the Great Commandment, how we ought to love our neighbor as ourselves. Both social morality and personal piety, practical compassion and personal purity, public compassion and private purity. I told you, we like to say, no, I'm all about, let's have Bible study, worship, prayer, evangelism. Don't tell me about engaging the culture and all this justice stuff. We've been co-opted by the social justice narrative. You know, we don't want to go there. Let's just focus on evangelism and prayer and Bible study. Again, that's absolutely necessary and important. And then others over here are saying, no, we're going to have to become a little more progressive in order for us to be relevant with our culture. We can't be traditional, conventional people who only focus on those sorts of things. And in order for us to be able to engage a younger, emerging progressive culture, we're really going to have to talk about social justice. We're really going to have to start engaging the world by making ourselves available. And James says, both and, not either or. Not just social morality on the one hand, and not just private piety on the other. You can't bifurcate the two. I wrote this and I reread it. I said, wow, that, actually sounds okay. And let me read it. A liberal person is individualistic when dealing with morality, but communal when it comes to dealing with money. A conservative person is individualistic about my money, but communal about morality. And James is speaking into all of that. He is saying what tends to happen, and others have pointed this out, we have to make sure that we don't fall off the horse on one side as opposed to the other. If you're saying, I'm only going to focus on this, then you're falling off the horse on one side. If you're saying, no, it's only about these issues, then you're falling off the horse just on that side. It is both and. In America, you know that there is the Black Lives Matter movement. And I don't have time to get into all of that. But do black lives matter? Absolutely. Black lives matter. There are all sorts of politicized issues with that movement. But people are not saying black lives matter only black lives matter, as if other lives don't matter. That's not what they're saying. I told you, you'll start getting a little uncomfortable. But here's the other comment. Well, guess what? Unborn children's lives matter. Oh, now those of you who were with me are now against me, right? See, James is saying you can't pick and choose. You can't fall off the horse on one over the other. You can't just say, oh, private piety issues. Well, let's make sure that we stand up for the rights of the unborn. Absolutely. But what about social issues? Being concerned about things that matter, recognizing that the image of God can be found in all racial minority, including, especially, in unborn children. It's both and. Blessed are the poor. The concept of the poor is determined both socially and spiritually. We can neither spiritualize nor materialize the interpretation. That's what people try to do. Oh, we're going to materialize it. So he's just talking about the poor. Oh, no, we're going to spiritualize it. Talk about poor in spirit. All I know is it does not say, blessed are the middle class in spirit. Keller has a really good kind of cultural critique and analysis on this, as he usually does. This is what he said. He said, we have to be careful that we don't allow the culture to colonize us. The reason for that is because a post-Christian culture is very different than a non-Christian or a pre-Christian culture, because they have no point of reference with Christianity. So most post-Christian cultures, they have been co-opted or have adopted or appropriated a lot of Christian ideas. So it has taken the issues of the poor and human rights and recognizing the value of every human being, which, again, all these ideas and principles are found in Christianity. However, they have extrapolated it to its individualistic extreme. So if you want to call it liberal individualism, you say things like, well, we need to do justice for the poor. I need to do racial justice stuff, but nobody should tell me what to do with my body. That's my own business. But on the other hand, if you're a traditionalist and a conservative, you'll say something like, don't tell me what I should do with my money. That's my private business, but I'll tell you how we can be communal about being able to spread morality as much as we can for our society. Again, if you just simply fall off the horse one way or the other, if I were to take a poll, possibly as it relates to your generational kind of differences, those of you, again, as I mentioned earlier, the ones who are slightly chronologically challenged might fall into one camp, and those of you who have a whole lot of vibrancy in life and younger and who tend to be a little more progressive and more empathetic to issues like this, you're going to lean one way or the other, and James doesn't give us that option. He doesn't. Because true religion does not give us a pass on one over the other. Then how do we apply true religion? How do we apply this this challenging message of being able to maintain the beautiful balance of recognizing the importance of the inner life and also engaging in a robust outer life. How is that possible? And let me say, Martin Lloyd-Jones said, there is a primacy that you need to place on the priority of the inner life. And I absolutely agree with that. I'm not saying one is the other or they're the same. They're different. I realize the declaration of the gospel takes priority over gospel demonstration. That is the result of the gospel that you proclaim and believe. I recognize that. But both are necessary. Both are signs that you understand the gospel. And so how do we apply true religion? Let me think through it this way. It says here, again, if anyone thinks, verse 27, religion that is pure and undefiled before God, the Father, is this. So we need to find a power that is pure and undefiled. So let's say you say, I'm going to accept both. So I'm going to take the responsibility of visiting orphans and widows in their affliction. And I'm also going to take the responsibility of taking this matter of the priority of the inner life and keeping myself undefiled and unpolluted and unstained from the world. I am not going to be worldly. I'm going to be godly. I will do all of these sorts of things. Is that the pure and undefiled religion? Yes, that's what James is saying. However, no one can meet the demand. You're going to fall off the horse one or the other. And even when you're on the one side of the horse, you're not going to be able to believe that or meet the demands of that perfectly. You won't. I won't. We're sinners in need of God's grace. We need the finished blood-bought work of Jesus in order to be able to make us whole. We need his passive righteousness. We need his active righteousness. We need Jesus to do for us what we can't ultimately do for ourselves. And therefore, we need to gain for ourselves, we need to receive a power that is pure and undefiled. The only individual who was able to keep himself completely unstained and unpolluted from the world, a lamb without blemish. Exodus 12:5. The language is very, very similar. 1 Peter 1:19, which also quotes that. It's not about just changing habits, but it's about finding a cleanliness, a sterilization, being sanitized completely. And without that, we will not be able to have any hope at all. This is my final thought and illustration. The Old Testament has the same relationship to all forms of defilement as a doctor has going into surgery. Now remember, 30% of my congregation is in healthcare, and out of them we have a specialty of every single specialized medical surgeon. I know because I read the Journal of American Medical Association from time to time just so the doctors know that I'm familiar with what they're trying to do. They always think that they know what I'm doing. So I have to tell them, you know, I mean, it's like what you're doing is not that difficult either. Okay, so. But I know this. I know that you can't go from an autopsy to the surgery room. For those of you who are in surgery, you know this to be true. You have to go through all sorts of cleansing, right? If I may use this analogy. Kind of like the Old Testament priest. You put on the gown, everything has to be sterilized. You walk around like this, you go to the scrubbing area. And what happens when you're scrubbing? Well, you're supposed to use the brush, but you know, you guys cheat and you don't do that. But anyways, when you're doing all of this, after you have to scrub from the elbow down. And then when you are taking the water off, you don't go like this because whatever you scrubbed here can fall down into the hands. So you go like this, right? This is what they do. This is their action, right? And And so what the Bible is trying to say is the Old Testament has the same relationship to all forms of defilement. What would be the defilement? It would be death, the deeds, right? The deadly deeds. Death, dirt, decay, and disease. That is why when you touch anything that was dead, or anyone who had some sort of a even pus or mold and mildew, you needed to cleanse yourself. It's not like they were just kind of overly neurotic and clean freaks like myself, but they, this was kind of demonstrating that they wanted to be completely cleansed from all impurities as they came before the presence of God. And what God is saying is that sin does the same thing to the soul that dirt, disease, and decay does to the body. And sin defiles the soul the way dirt, disease, and decay defiles the body. Now, I have a classic illustration for this. So my youngest daughter, who just went off to college, Michigan, go blue. Okay, you don't know. You don't know what that means. But anyways, and when she was a young girl, we were at a restaurant with some friends, and she was, you know, getting restless, and she was rocking back and forth on this chair. At the top edge of the back part of the chair was kind of a very straight, sharp metal rod. And being a neurotic parent, I just would kind of look over like this and being concerned, oh no, what if she falls? And sure enough, boom, she falls, and she put her chin right on the sharp edge of that metal bar, and there was a huge, not a cut, a laceration. It was so deep, it wasn't even bleeding. And so you know that there is the outer layer and there is the whatever, the epidermis and the hypodermis, whatever. There are different layers of skin and fat there. And I freaked out, so thankfully the children's hospital was nearby, so I went there, and I'm being a neurotic father and say, hurry up, you know, like her life is in danger, you got to do something. And they just say, look, it's only a laceration, just hold your cool and be cool. And then finally, we went to see the doctor who was working in the ED department at that particular time. Thankfully, he or she was not a resident. Right, not that I have anything against residents, but yeah, they need more experience, okay? So anyway, so this person was actually attending. And so I was like, okay, good. So I asked, are you a resident or are you attending? So I'm an attending. I said, okay, good. And so I asked him, so what's your course of action? So what are you going to do? So he kind of looked at it and said, yeah, I'll just, you know, suture it up, put a few stitches and all that. And I said, hold on for a moment. So I called my dermatology surgeon, who's an inactive elder, who's a Mohs specialist, right? So there are only like seven of him in my state. And I said, hey, listen, Dennis. So this was what happened to Charlotte, and we're about to go into surgery. You need to come right now. So to his credit, he shows up. And I said, okay, I know this is not your hospital, but kind of assert your authority. Go over there, tell him what you do, and give your recommendation. And to that attending's emergency doctor's credit, he was willing to listen. So I said, go ask him how many he's going to put in there. So how many are you going to do? He said, I think I'm just going to put three here in the inner layer. And he said, I wouldn't do that. I said, what would you do? I said, I'd probably put in 14. Because if you put in three, you're going to have lumps, right? You're going to have lumps. Even though you suture it up nicely on the outer part of the skin there. So I said, okay, good. Tell him 14 times. Put it in there. And then he says, well, how many times are you going to do the outer layer? And he told him. And I said, do you have confidence in doing this? He says, not really. So I told my elder, I said, tell them to call the plastic surgeon on call. He said, they're not going to call the plastic surgeon for a laceration on the chin. I said, do it. Right? Tiger dad. And so he told the attending, he said, hey, can you please, you know, ask if the plastic surgeon on call would be willing to come in? He said, are you serious? He said, yeah, he's asking me to ask you. Can you just, okay, I'll call. I'll see. So he calls him, and I can see him, and he's just kind of shaking his head. And somehow, by God's grace, he showed up. So the plastic surgeon comes and says, so what's the issue? He takes a look at it. Are you serious? You called me in for this? So anyways, so they allowed me to I know, it's amazing that they allowed me to go into the surgery room with everyone else. My wife and my elder, we all kind of put on the robes and we went in there. And what they did was they needed to create a sterile field. Again, those of you who are in medicine, you know this. To create, you need all of the tools that you're going to use to be utterly sterilized. And they have different colored towels, just in case you're confused, right? So it wasn't the blue towels, but it was the green towels. And so he was creating a sterile field, and there he was creating a sterile field. So everything, the towels, the instruments, the physicians and the attending nurses, they all needed to make sure that they were completely sanitized and sterilized so that they would not break the sterile field. And so they're going about doing their business, and they created the sterile field. But I noticed that there was a green cloth that was kind of hitting my daughter's chin like that. And so I wanted to be helpful. So I reached over and removed the towel, and everyone went, and I said, "What's the problem?" And my wife is in the corner shaking her head. So you just broke the sterile field. So what do they have to do? They have to break it down, get new towels, and they have to create the sterile field, which delayed the whole process another 15, 20 minutes, and they did all of that. What's my point? When you're creating a sterile field, you cannot allow an unsterile instrument or personnel to break that which is clean. That's exactly what I did. I'm an unsterile personnel, reached out across the sterile field, that which was clean, and I contaminated it. I defiled it. I completely polluted it. Jesus, on the other hand, is a perfectly sterile personnel who reached across the unsterile area in our lives and touched and saved and purified a polluted humanity. He was willing to cross the boundaries when he was completely pure and undefiled, completely unpolluted. He was completely pure and holy and set apart, and he crossed the barrier and became polluted legally on our behalf so that we who are unclean might become clean. He received the uncleanliness that we deserved, and we received the cleanliness that he deserved. That's exactly what happened in the gospel. And when we know this to be true, even though we know that we're going to utterly fail to be able to meet the demands of both public morality and private piety, we know that we will never be able to obey this perfectly, even though we're asked, and rightfully so, to obey this. Your life will never be radically transformed unless you look to this one individual who was only one individual in history who was not polluted, who was not stained, who was not defiled, who was utterly, utterly pure, utterly, utterly set apart, utterly, utterly the other. Talk about breaking the sterile field. He didn't come from a different zip code. He came from a different place. He came down from heaven, incarnated himself to a dirty, polluted world, reached out his hand to a polluted humanity, and gave us life and cleansed us. And gave us hope that is in the resurrection. And friends, if that's what you know to be true, which it is, then we will be able to look at people who have needs. Friends, mercy is not a luxury. Mercy is a necessity. It's not an accessory. When you woke up this morning and you were putting on your clothing, you might not have worn jewelry or a belt or, I don't know, a headband or a hat or whatever. Those are all accessories. You don't necessarily need that. But you all needed to put on a shirt and pants or skirts or, right? That's what mercy is. Doing justice and loving mercy and being merciful to people, this is not an elective for those people who like that kind of stuff. We're all called to be merciful. Why? Because we are recipients of God's mercy. He demonstrated grace to people who didn't deserve his grace. And therefore, we ought to be the most generous, most gracious, most merciful, most forgiving, most loving, most fair, equitable people that this world knows. And when they see that, their hearts will be stirred to wanting to find an object of a longing that they have in their hearts for their affections to be utterly satisfied. And that's what we're praying for through our gospel demonstration and what James is calling us to be. Let's pray. Gracious Father in heaven, we thank you for these very simple verses where James describes for us what is true religion, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows, the categories of groups of people who are part of the vulnerable and needy and weak in the world, in their affliction. And on the other hand, to also keep ourselves unstained and unpolluted from the world. You're calling us to both being merciful and godly, a life that is filled with piety, but also willing to do justice. You're calling us to a counterintuitive and countercultural life, a reality that the world does not know. And when they see that, may they be drawn and attracted to Jesus. In his name we pray.